And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, goons, and welcome to another edition of the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I'm the Chris Keeper, and I'm bringing you a special episode to bend your bloody ears around. Tonight we present you with The Music of Murder, The Melody of Mayhem, Tunes of Terror, and Gritty Ditties of Doom. It's the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror soundtrack episode.
Hello and welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. And we have a little special transitory episode here where we're going to focus on the greatest, in our opinions, horror soundtracks of all times. And I am Chris Honeywell, and I'm here with my co-host, the Hair Metal Hero.
Yeah, hey everybody.
And Luke Giaconetti.
Hey, how you doing tonight, guys?
And we had kind of a month off there in the Big Monkey month. Kind of glad to be back. Yeah, we're going in a new direction after this, so we'll talk about that at the end of the show. But this time, we have carefully compiled our lists of what we think are the greatest horror movie soundtracks of all time.
All time. And before we get started, guys, I do want to just say real quick, I'd like to dedicate this episode to Mr. Ernest Borgnine, who
Amen.
Passed away today as we're recording this. Ernest Borgnine, of course, played Cabby in Escape from New York.
Oh, Snake Plissken in my cab? Wait till I tell Eddie. Hey, hang on, Snake.
He played Harry Booth in The Black Hole, one of my favorites. He was in The Poseidon Adventure, The Wild Bunch, lots of other great films. One of the last great tough guy character actors, I think. He died today as we're recording this, so this one goes out to Ernest Borgnine and to his family.
Yeah, I was really bummed to hear that. Also, the voice of the indigestible Wad on the Ripping Friends cartoon.
Yes.
But oh my God, every time I see a pug dog, it reminds me of Ernest Borgnine. If you put a little cabby hat on him. Yeah.
He went too soon.
Yeah, what was he, like 95?
Yeah, something like that. Also, he was Dom on Airwolf, and I'll never forget that. One of my favorite shows. So.
Oh my God, how could I forget that? Yeah, even a great TV career. Yeah, he was sort of the actor version of Don Rickles. He and Don Rickles were cut from the same cloth. Don Rickles was like went the comedian direction, and it was like they were, you know, born from the same parents or something. Separated at birth.
Yep.
All right, anyway, music. I know this has been a long time on the Two True Freaks Network that we've done a soundtrack show, so I'm really excited about it. I think the last time was like 2.5 years ago when Scott and I did like our favorite TV themes, and I probably would have tried to haul Scott's lazy butt into this show also, but I know he's not a big horror fan, so I think
his opinion of this show in general is also fairly low, so.
Yes, thankfully he doesn't hold that against the co-host.
Yeah,
he can separate the art from the artist.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do? Whale and
Gnash
Teeth.
We're going to talk about the soundtrack.
Yes, we are.
So we had a crossover.
Which I sort of knew was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was funny. We had when we were discussing this, we all sort of came up with the same thing of that. Yeah, we didn't have a really... didn't feel that any of us had a really unpredictable list or anything with some stuff.
No.
There's some stuff out of left field, I'm sure, for when we were reading off each other's list. But we ended up with, six soundtracks in common, three of which all three of us picked, and the other three two of us picked. Not bad. That's sort of how I figured the dice would fall out.
Yeah.
So, let's see. Should I...
Just throw one out there.
The first one we got since we did it last month was Halloween, which, how can, you know... I mean, that's almost like the first one that comes to mind because it's just so iconic.
Yeah, I think if there was an award for winning the most top 10 lists on the internet for best horror movie soundtracks, this one would take it home. Because not only is it, it's just iconic as a score, I think also it's become so much part of the popular culture when it comes to horror film that people who have never seen Halloween know the main Halloween theme and know, oh, that's the theme from Halloween, you know?
Yeah.
It transcends just being a soundtrack, and now it's just general scary holiday music.
Yes, it makes its way onto a lot of the, like, mix albums that they make for people to play out on their front porch during Halloween and stuff, you know? it's unstoppable and machine-like, like Michael Myers, you know? It has, like, three major themes, and it just really runs them into the ground, you know, methodically and ruthlessly, which is sort of what Michael Myers is doing to his victims in the movie. And so, you know, I mean, listening to the soundtrack is a creepy, creepy experience if you listen to it from front to, you know, beginning to end. And what seems at first to be also a very simplistic sort of synthesized soundtrack, you know, there's a lot of little subtleties to it and just nice stuff thrown in there. But, you know, I'm also, John Carpenter is one of my favorite soundtrack composers, so there you go.
Yeah, and the thing is, like I said, a lot of people know that main theme, but the score, even though it only really uses about, like you said, three or four different motifs, there it gets some real good mileage out of the secondary themes. You know, I talked about this in our Halloween episode, but the kind of ting 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 song that plays when Laurie runs across the street and the shape is coming across the street at her, that's one of the scariest pieces of music in film. You know, combination mise-en-scène of music and cinema. You know, it's ever been made. That's just it. Just always, I said at the time, it sets your teeth on edge to watch that, and that's just a, you know, it's just a secondary piece from the soundtrack, but it. You know, everything works. One thing about with Carpenter's films, and we've discussed this at length during our Carpenter series, is that because he's 9 times out of 10 writing his own music, he knows exactly what he wants with the soundtrack. He's not trying to, communicate it to a composer who then is going to match it, and then there's back and forth, which can produce its own artistic, dynamic interaction. But here, he's getting exactly what he is hearing in his head when he's shooting it. So that you know, it's kind of a one-to-one relationship.
Yeah, and I like also that, you know, as he's writing his own stuff, you end up with a lot of really minimalist music with it, which goes really well with horror movies. And, you know, I tend to think that's not because he's as much of a minimalist composer as he's not gilding the lilies. He's not like a composer with a job saying, well, I better put some flourishes here and some pretty stuff here and stuff. No, he's being completely like craftsman-like with it, and just being like, what do I need here for the mood? And he just puts it in there.
Yeah, you don't need a 70-piece orchestra for a dude in a William Shatner mask killing babysitters.
No, it would probably put a damper on the festivities, actually.
It would just be too overblown at that point. It would just take all the tension away.
Okay, so the next one on our list goes into the supernatural, and that's The Exorcist, which is Tubular Bells, basically.
Tubular Bells. Yeah. And actually, if you want to make set yourself up for a big disappointment, and I don't know why you would want to do this.
Listen to Tubular Bells.
Listen to Tubular Bells. Right. At the second half of the album is some stuff that's not from The Exorcist, and it sucks.
I have bad associations with Tubular Bells because I was in a car where we were listening to Tubular Bells really loud when a car came out of nowhere. It was like out of one of those movies and totaled our car. This lady who was taking a car for a test drive. She had no license, and she ran a red light and just broadsided us in Cincinnati, and listening to Tubular Bells, which the one of the reasons it made my list is just because, you know, it's this sort of new age piece of music that was supposed to be this like meditative, beautiful thing. But once you flopped it down into the context of The Exorcist, it became some of the most evil music sounding music of all time. Yep. And now the association will never rub off, you know. Yep. People listen to that music and they think about, you know, it used to be you were supposed to think about, I think, like waves on the shore and seagulls and pleasant thoughts. And now you think, and now it's demon possession and heads and vomit and heads turning all the way around.
And sucking cocks in hell.
Yes, mothers sucking cocks in hell, yes.
Oh man, you know, it's funny you mentioned that about it being a new wave piece. I'm still waiting for Enya to release an atmospheric horror score. That shit would be awesome.
Why you do this to me, Demi?
but it's like you said, it's one that's just become so associated with the film that it was in, and especially again given. I don't want to say the popularity. I think the notoriety of The Exorcist when it was released, you know, as it really stuck with a lot of people, and the film itself had such a reputation when it was released that music became kind of instantly ingrained. There's an honorable mention film on my list when we get to the individual list that has kind of a similar effect. And again, it's just identified completely with it, and it serves the purpose of a good soundtrack insofar as if you hear Tubular Bells, you can't help but think about The Exorcist. It's kind of like when you hear Stuck in the Middle with You now.
Yes.
You know, you can't think about it without, you know, just throwing gas on the guy and dancing around the whole nine.
That song is completely ruined for me. And it's so goddamn catchy, but it's like, nope, all I can think about is a cop getting his ear cut off. Thank you, Billy D, Super Sounds of the 70s. You wrote it.
All right, the next one on our list has a little connection since The Exorcist main character was Damien. This one's The Omen. Just everybody's heard that theme that says evil.
And it's like 180 degrees away from The Exorcist.
Yeah.
You know, like you were just saying, Chris, that The Exorcist is, Tubular Bells was originally, you know, kind of meditative, calm, you know, just kind of new agey music. This is, you know, the choral Spiritus Dominus. I mean, every Catholic knows creepy ass music like that when they hear it, you know. We kind of have it ingrained in us by birth, so it was like, oh shit, the Satan stuff's coming out now.
Oh yeah, grand gothic.
I always thought before I knew my composers and stuff, and you know, and I didn't pay any attention to it, and that I knew that you know who Jerry Goldsmith was. When I was a kid, I thought this was just like classical. Like, you know, Catholic music that they played. And and now that I think back at it, I'm like, what church service would have that music, you know? That's
none that I've ever been to.
Exactly.
A lot of them.
Yep. It's so funny.
That would get me out to Catholic church. That would get me out to church as if that was, you know, if that's what was going on, you know.
Let's say my friend Jonathan used to joke that at the end when the father's dragging Damien into church, that was about what it was like for him to get, for his parents to get him to go to church was, no, dad, no, no, you know.
Oh, man. I'm glad that I would have been the kind of kid that would have like hid smoke bombs underneath my shirt, so like when I went under the and I'd start to smoke and writhe around on the ground.
Yeah, you know that would go well at a fundamentalist church. The Catholics would just go, eh.
Again, this one is a little more obvious just because it sounds so creepy. And, again, considering the time frame it was released my brother has a degree in math. Okay. And he was doing a statistics project in college. Basically, he was compiling people's responses to certain horror films. And he found, and he went to school in New York, went to school in, kind of up by your neck of the woods. He went to SUNY Albany, mm-hmm. Chris.
Okay.
And so he's doing a survey about and was people's responses to certain types of horror films, and he found overwhelmingly that anything that dealt with the satanic got the most overwhelmingly negative emotional response from the people that he questioned, and I think that kind of goes along with this is that we are for good or ill whatever your opinion on this is. The United States is a Judeo-Christian based country.
Yes.
And so anytime you're dealing with Satanism or the occult or things of that nature, that automatically strikes a emotional chord with you. And I think if you can, reproduce that in musical form, it's going to, those nerve pathways in your brain have already been written. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
Yes. So you hear that spiritus, and that's it. You're already like, it brings you right back to the emotional state that you were in when you watched it.
Well, no matter what, like, sort of, like, if you were a, like, Baptist or Catholic or whatever, the there's, sort of the belief in Satan or evil runs through all of them. So, like, movies like that are just more theoretically plausible to a larger swath of the population than,
right,
say, a Bigfoot movie or a zombie movie or something.
Man, Bigfoot's fucking real.
Well, there's a swath of people who, that a Bigfoot movie would be extra scary to them, but there's just more people, I think, that believe in Satan The Exorcist, my aunt made her kids wear crosses after seeing The Exorcist, My cousin got, like, pneumonia and was laying in bed going, and my aunt flipped out, after seeing that movie, flipped out. And she wasn't like church going, she'd gone to church a little when she was younger, but that movie just like was, a lot of people saw that movie and went, oh my God, this is possible. And, at the time people were like, and this is based on actual, true, exorcisms that have been performed by the Catholic Church and is based on what really happens in them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, people glom, that's, the stuff that could technically happen always is more resonant.
Just real, real quick on an aside. You mentioned a Bigfoot movie to be extra scary. Have you seen the movie Bigfoot with John Carradine?
Yes.
Yeah, the tagline is Bigfoot breeds ago. Breeds with anything.
Oh.
Yeah, that movie's scary for all the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Slap my ass and call me Bigfoot.
Not to be confused with Sasquatch.
Yeah, that's a totally different
movie. Oh, yeah.
The Legend of Boggy Creek.
And that's like Legend of Boggy, the Legend of Boggy Creek 2, another. That's what you got, Bigfoot Month. When are you gonna do Bigfoot Month?
That's a good idea.
Missing Link Month. Oh man. Oh, that would be frightening because there's so many bad Sasquatch movies. Oh boy.
No, it's a good soundtrack. The Omen. The Omen's a great soundtrack.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Okay, so that's our unanimous picks. Now we come to the next three, which are ones that only two of us would have in common. And the first one sort of goes along with The Omen and The Exorcist in a little ways, where it has that sort of supernatural aspect with a little bit of cheese added to it, and that's the Phantasm soundtrack, which everybody knows I love, and The Hero, I think you've vocalized your devotion to the soundtrack too. It is the theme to the show, you know.
Yeah, I can't even do it because it's so awesome. Yeah, it's just that one is just, man, that is atmosphere and mood right in your face from the very beginning.
Well, I like it because it has the tubular bells aspect to it, but it also has a little bit of that European cheesy synthesized to it, the 70s, you know, a little 70s damage to it, which works really well in the dreamy sort of dreamlike atmosphere of the movie. And actually there's a lot of different kind of feels and movements to this movie, and the soundtrack's constantly changing, and I think it was sort of ahead of its time in that. I think a lot of that aspect of soundtracks started showing up in stuff like Evil Dead, you know, Dead by Dawn, Evil Dead 2 type era. Almost like a horror soundtrack with a little bit of fun thrown in there, a little bit of cheesy fun without sacrificing, you know. Phantasm didn't have a lot. It had some fairly humorous parts in it, but for the most part it was pretty creepy.
Yeah.
You know, you had some scenes with the midget creatures and the giant flies and stuff that were played for fun, but I always looked at this movie, like the soundtrack and the movie, to be sort of a template for the Sam Raimi sort of stuff that hit like in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, and sort of the Darkman type of movies, which I think the Phantasm movies sort of developed into, especially by Phantasm 3, into that sort of overblown aspect of it.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned you mentioned the dreamlike quality. I would almost take it one step further. I think this, of all the soundtracks we've discussed so far, this one is one of the first to really embrace the kind of hallucinatory aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that is the I think that's one of the main strengths of Phantasm. Phantasm is such an odd film visually, the story. Everything of it it really was a lot different than anything that had come before it. Now, as you say, it devolved fairly quickly. Phantasm 2 is hilarious to me because they literally just stopped shooting when they ran out of money. So, but no, it embraces that not quite real, not quite a dream, middle ground really well. That's something I think I've always liked about the Phantasm soundtrack.
Yeah, it's a horror movie, but then when they start finding the tuning forks that lead into another dimension and stuff, it develops that science fiction feel, almost like that. It almost reminds me of points in the Flash Gordon soundtrack, you know, by Queen. You know, it's just a lot weird, like
Everything about Phantasm is just wacky, but awesome.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorite movies of ever. It was one of those great things where I had to. It was one of those movies where I had to catch it by staying up, you know, till 1 in the morning, and it was after an episode. I had to stay. Like midnight was an episode of Kolchak, and then after the Kolchak show was the movie. And it was usually either Phantasm or Forbidden Planet.
Yeah.
And so both of those I saw, like, and when you're a little kid, like, staying up till 3 in the morning to watch a movie is, like, a struggle to stay awake. But especially when a movie's, like, fascinating, I think it almost puts you into that almost dream state because you're trying to stay awake.
I'm trying to think. I was going to say, if I was that young watching Phantasm, I'd be like, I wouldn't be sleeping after that. It would scare the bejesus out of me.
I'm trying to remember. There was a show that was on USA called Up All Night. What was the name of the host?
They had
the girl
several
that hosted
hosts.
That. No, I remember Ronda there was Shea. Ronda. Yeah, she had that Ronda kind of squeaky Shea. Voice.
Yeah, and the massive titty. And was Gilbert Gottfried one of them too?
Gilbert Gottfried hosted it for a little while, but I remember when Ronda Shear hosted it. They showed. I remember that was where I saw Phantasm was on Up All Night.
I used to watch Up All Night and USA Night Flight the time. And they
Dynamite.
Were always good. Yeah, they were always good for. See, you know, I mean, that's the first place I ever got to see Eraserhead, Liquid Sky, Andy Warhol's Frankenstein.
So I think I saw Razorback on one of those, and
Deadly
Alligator.
Deadly Alligator.
Great Alligator, the Great Alligator.
Oh, the Great Alligator.
Yes. Yeah.
Some of the best movies on USA Up All Night were all the teen sex comedies, though. I'll never forget there was one that was called Buford's Beach Bunnies, and it had Tom Hanks' brother in it. Oh my god. Track that shit down and laugh your ass off. That's scary for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Oh god.
Yeah.
I remember Gilbert Gottfried.
How can you forget him?
Can you forget?
Heyday of obnoxiousness, yes. All right, so we have one more on our list, and then we get to go to all of our oddballs that we've all picked. Or no, we have two more on the list. I'm sorry, I'm not paying attention. The first one is Alien, another Jerry Goldsmith score. And is that another one that you and I had in common, Hero? I think all three of these you and I had in common, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
The score for that is just, it starts off and it's very mellow. It's almost like it's lulling you to sleep a little bit. And by the time shit starts going down in that movie, the score completely changes. And it's just, I think it works really well from the quiet scenes all the way to when Ripley's just running her ass off at the end of the movie. It's just, it's unrelenting. And it never overstays its welcome. It plays each scene where there is score, it plays just long enough to have an impact.
Yeah, and it's funny that you use the word lulling you at the beginning, because my note was at the beginning of it, it's the beginning theme music is almost like a lullaby. It's just sort of like a, you know, just a very peaceful, you're waking up and, you know, just sort of taking a little stroll through the ship. And yeah, and as it goes on, it just becomes more and more menacing until, you know, it's beyond the point of menacing and it's a fight for survival. And it's a very understated score. It's almost like if you're not paying attention, you could miss it. But, you know, I've watched the movie so many times.
Yeah. And what really blows your mind is when you get down to after Ripley's the last one left, there is no dialogue for the rest of the fucking movie.
Yeah.
It's just the sound effects, her grunting, and the score. And that's it. I mean, that tells you all you need to know. I mean, what else can you say? I mean, it's Goldsmith's music along with just that, oh my god, is she going to get off the ship? And is she even going to make it? So, I don't know. I don't know what else to say about that one.
I think you guys each picked, each had a great adjective. Hero, you said unrelenting. And and Chris, you said, I think, unassuming.
Yes.
And I think that's true, because you're right. It starts out, it's unassuming, and we don't think much about it, but it never, you know, it keeps on coming, and it keeps getting more and more, you know, worse, you know, just like the narrative does. So, you know, that again, Alien's one that I think sometimes, like you say, gets overlooked, just because I think the visuals of Alien are kind of what everybody remembers more so than anything else. But that's another one that, like I said with Halloween, the mise-en-scène, the combination of all the elements, you know, into one effect is very, very well done. And it really, I mentioned earlier, again, sometimes you get that dynamic synthesis between a director and a composer creating the visuals and the audio. And I think Alien's a real good example of that. You've got two very, talented artists working together to produce something that is bigger than the sum of its parts. When you've got, Scott and Goldsmith working together.
Well, and you see how flexible Goldsmith is, especially when you compare this soundtrack to The Omen, which is not unassuming at all. It's literally like hovering over your head, screaming like on a cloud of fire,
Yeah.
Yeah. And how does Alien end? What, the music in that? Lullaby again.
Yeah, back to sleep.
It takes you all the way. Then waking up from cry to sleep. Abject terror, back.
Sounds like a typical work day to me. I don't know.
Yeah,
I had a job in 6 months.
It's a typical work day in Ripley's world. That's for sure. From that point on, pretty much. She doesn't even get to die, and they bring her back.
You know what she needs? Hero, you'd appreciate this. She needs the shirt that Steve Austin had when he came back after a couple of years. That says, arrive, raise hell, leave.
Yes. Yes, I would love to see Sigourney Weaver cracking two Budweisers and just pouring them right down her gullet. That would be awesome. Unfortunately, you'd have to save something for that, like that for Vasquez from Aliens.
Yeah.
All right, so our last one on the list is one that also made way back in the early days of Two True Freaks. I'm sure it was on our best soundtracks of all time list, and that is Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
Yeah. You know what's funny about us talking about Jaws is that I just had an opportunity. I'm a little behind on the Commentary Monthly Monday episodes just because of their length.
Mm-hmm.
Which is ironic on a Two True Freaks show. It's like a Two True Freaks show running long? No!
How could that be? Yeah.
But I just a couple weeks ago got to listen to your Jaws commentary, which I would highly recommend anyone who's listening who hasn't downloaded that one to grab a copy of, because it's really, really good commentary. But what's interesting is, while you guys are talking, every now and again you get quiet during the intense scenes because you're watching the movie. Yeah. And so all you hear on the commentary is now the soundtrack.
Bum, 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 bum,
so I've heard a good bit of the Jaws soundtrack lately.
The thing that blows my mind about that soundtrack is it does start off as it's another horror movie soundtrack that has way disparate elements. It starts off as that unrelenting bum 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 bum, and by the time they're all on the Orca ready to set out, what kind of score does it become? It's a swashbuckler.
Yeah, it's like this inspirational, happy maritime theme. It's very fun and light.
And which then only goes to anytime that you're waiting, then it's even more disconcerting when you hear that the Bruce theme come in, because they're sitting there telling jokes and shooting the shit, and then oh fuck, here comes the shack again. Well, that didn't last too long.
Yeah.
Well, like Halloween, it's one of those soundtracks where the soundtrack is playing a character, big time, and in this one the soundtrack was definitely covering some. Covering some slack from the malfunctioning shark, so I'm sure
the shark is beautiful.
I'm sure that from what was left, but
salvage.
Won't say it. All I was gonna say was think about this. How they got how much footage of Bruce in Jaws? You edited it all together, probably what, a couple minutes, right?
Just a few minutes.
Right. How many seconds of footage do we get of RoboKong in King Kong 1976? 4 seconds? So close.
That's true.
Yeah, so it's all relative.
I thought you were going to say, how many seconds of RoboKong do we get in King Kong Escapes? And I was going to say, hey, he gets plenty of time in that one.
Mechanikong is all over that damn movie because he's awesome.
Yeah.
He gets minutes at a time.
We see Mechanikong before we see King Kong in that movie. Okay?
Mm-hmm. I just can't stay mad at that robot monkey.
All right, so now we're getting into the disparate, into all of our. This is where you get to see the quirks of all of us, and so who wants to go first with one of theirs on the list?
I'll drop one because we can cover it real quick. John Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, awesome!
What else needs to be said? I mean, go back and listen to our regular episode about it. It's a great score, regardless of who actually composed it. It's a great score. It's the same thing. It's moody and atmospheric and driving.
It
makes you feel uncomfortable the whole time.
Well, I'm glad that you picked that one because Morricone needs to be in the. It's, you know, we got Jaws. You know, okay, so John Williams is representing. You know,
Jerry Goldsmith.
So you gotta have Ennio Morricone somewhere in there, and you know, him doing a soundtrack to a John Carpenter movie. All right, I'll deal with John Carpenter not doing it, and he delivers a fairly John Carpenter-y soundtrack at points. You know, it's a very restrained Morricone soundtrack, which works perfectly for that movie. You know, that, I mean.
In fact, I think in our regular episode, I think one of us made the comment that we thought it was Carpenter who scored the film.
There's a lot of back and forth information out there about who actually did what on that.
But, okay.
Regardless of who did it, it fits the film.
Yeah.
All right, Luke, how about you?
Well, I'm going to drop a pair of films that made my list as honorable mentions. And I made my list as honorable mentions mainly because their scores as a whole are really nothing to write home about. But both of them have really cool theme songs that they are known by. But that's about the extent. It's not like Halloween where they've got a great theme and then the rest of the soundtrack is just as good. The first I want to talk about is Puppet Master by Charles Band. And the Puppet Master theme song is, you know, just this kind of clockwork sounding, old-timey, sort of theme that plays at the beginning of every Puppet Master film. And you guys know I love the Puppet Master films, probably more than I should. What I've always loved about this is that, you know, Charles Band and his company's Full Moon Entertainment and some of the ones that came before him, to me, they were always basically one step above television anyway. They were, you know, pretty much all direct-to-video. He had a few that got released theatrically, but most of the stuff went straight to home video. So the Puppet Master theme song always sounded like it could be from a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like the best unmade horror TV show theme ever. You know, it's a little bit low-rent, a little bit cheesy, but it fits the series perfectly. Because the series is a little low rent and a little cheesy. So I've always liked that one. That one always brings a smile to my face. And I always love, it'll always get mentioned. It'll always be that one oddball on the list when you see the top 10 best horror themes. Always have Puppet Master on there. And they'll all say the same things. Like, the movies may not be that great, but Charles Band sure wrote a good piece of music for the first one, didn't he? You know?
That's why it's at the beginning of every one after that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Well, say, his artistic abilities, we can argue about, but Charles Band knew how to save money and make money. Okay. You know, that's why the guy's still making movies that are still making him some money now. So, I mean, you can't argue with success, you know, whatever your measure of success is. The other one I want to throw out there is the movie and the series Saw, and specifically the piece of music Hello Zep, which doesn't play at the beginning. It plays at the end of every Saw film as all the plot details are laid bare for the audience. And again, the soundtrack to the Saw films has a mix of usually some industrial metal and some scored stuff. The scores never really did much for me, but this piece has kind of taken on in the modern context, kind of what Tubular Bells and the theme from The Omen did in the 70s, is they're so closely tied with the series that they're associated with. It's so closely tied with the Saw films that I think anyone who has seen them can't hear Hello Zep without thinking about the Saw films, and specifically the more gruesome elements therein that are the ones that stick with you, you know. As I said, the rest of the soundtracks don't really do much for me, but I think that's just a great piece, and the way that it's used throughout the series is very consistent, and I think it's well done and just well put together. Real quick, talking about Saw, my father and I did too. We both watched the show Lost, right? And Michael Emerson played a character on Lost named Benjamin Linus, okay? And he's gone on to appear in a few other things. He's on a show called Person of Interest, which is a really good show if you folks haven't seen it. And I was talking to my dad about it, and he said, well, I can't watch that because every time I look at it, it's Ben Linus from Lost. And I said, yeah, Dad, except that's Zepp from Saw every time I see it, because he was in Saw before he was in Lost. So, you know, I keep expecting, Ben Linus to say, it's the rules, or something to that effect on Lost, and it never happens. So, moral of the story, don't typecast people based on what they played previously. And, but yeah, that's I wanted to throw those out there because not really memorable scores, but certainly memorable themes. And in horror, sometimes a good theme is all you need sometimes.
Well, that's perfect because that leads into one of mine, which is Psycho by Bernard Herrmann, which in general is a good score, but it's definitely, and all the subsequent Psycho movies had that same, the same theme, you know, at least once or twice would show up. You know, the shrieking violins that we all know means somebody's getting stabbed repeatedly. The music that's become synonymous with people like killing other people in public. You know, I can't tell you how many people have pulled out a knife at some time, and I've seen just go usually when talking about a psycho girlfriend or something like that.
one of the best iterations of the psycho theme is in the movie High Anxiety by Mel Brooks.
Yes.
kid gets no tip.
Here's your pay. I got your paper.
Oh, man. That's a long time.
And you know, what's interesting is a composer who I don't have any of his stuff on my list just because of the genres he works in, but someone who references Psycho and some of the other soundtracks to Hitchcock is Danny Elfman. Mm-hmm. If you listen to Elfman's score for Pee-wee's Big Adventure, for example, there's a lot of stuff from Psycho and Vertigo and some of the another Bernard, some of the other scores in there that it's all directly referenced back to it. I think it speaks more about Elfman than it does anything else, you know?
Yeah, well, Bernard Herrmann's another one of those classic composers that you almost, it's like Morricone and John Williams and Goldsmith, you gotta sort of, they gotta poke their nose in here somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of any of the other classic, you know, soundtrack guys, but who was the guy who did the Pink Panther?
Mancini.
I've never heard a Mancini horror theme, but I'll bet you he could have done a good horror.
He had to have.
He probably did, but I can't think of it any on off the top of my head. But that's what our forum is for.
Yeah,
it's for people to go, no, you idiot, he did this iconic horror theme.
How could you idiots get that wrong?
Exactly. Alright, Hero, it's back to you.
Okay. I'll throw out a Nightmare on Elm Street, because I like that one a lot.
It's a good one.
It is a good one.
And it's, if you're going to try to create a dreamlike sound, I think that one works pretty well. It's an ominous score. You know, a little tinkling at the beginning. It sends shivers up my spine when I watched the movie. So, yeah, I like that one.
And that's another one that I think gets overlooked just because as the franchise went on, it became more and more about how many bands we can stuff on the soundtrack.
Yes.
Yeah. And please don't get me wrong, I love Dream Warriors by Dokken.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, so good.
That's a great song. But you know, occasionally they not such a good fit. You know,
right. It was a better fit on MTV as a song, you know, as a video, than in an actual. Yeah, didn't it actually like come down to like there were rap songs and stuff like that by the end? Yeah,
I believe so. Yeah. Now let me ask you this, since we're talking about somebody's, I know Alice Cooper has a role in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 6. Did he have anything on the soundtrack?
I don't know.
I can't believe that they didn't do a remix of Welcome to My Nightmare or something for it, you know. You know, a P Diddy version of Welcome to My Nightmare, something to play over the end credits. That would be almost irresistible, it seems like. I think it was a couple years early for that, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, Iggy Pop sang the movie's title song.
Well, I can't really argue with that too much.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Alice Cooper, come on.
I think they're about the same age too. That's the scary part.
Well, you know, Alice plays he plays Freddy's stepfather in it's six. It's Freddy's dead is what he's in there. You know, that's just awesome, but. Now, see, Nightmare and the soundtrack for 2 is very similar to the soundtrack for 1.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think, again, much like I was saying before, I think a lot of it is when you're exposed to this. I mean, Hiro, you and I, we're kids of the 80s, you know, so we grew up with when Nightmare on Elm Street was current. It wasn't kitschy like it is now, you know?
Oh, no. When the first movie came out, I remember going to see that in the movie theater, and that was some scary shit. That was state-of-the-art scary movie shit.
It is, and the thing is that even now, you know, that there's talking about a franchise that was, dulled down as time went on and just became jokey. I mean, the original Nightmare on Elm Street is still a scary movie. And
1, 2, and 3, yeah.
And the soundtrack plays a role in that because it's menacing. You know, we've got a character that really, when you get down to it, looks somewhat clownish with the bright red and green sweater and the hat and everything. It's like that's kind of the point, is that he looks a little ridiculous. But his menace is always spelled out for you by the soundtrack. And I think that's, it's an aspect of the film that a lot of people don't remember until you're watching, and then all the little motifs and such that are in the soundtrack all come back to you, you know. And if you ever go to see a Nightmare on Elm Street film in the theater, there will be a couple of girls there singing the Freddy Krueger,
jump rope song, yeah.
That in and of itself is fucking creepy, because I mean, you can think about some small town having something like that pop up in real life, you know, some asshole went around killing people and, you know, urban legend, and then there you go,
If you take little girls chanting nursery rhymes and put a lot of reverb on them, it automatically just sounds horrifying. It sounds like little dead girl ghosts doing their thing. So it's almost like clown music. Yeah, right. Yeah, with good reason.
But it's the Nightmare series. I'm sure we'll get to it eventually. I mean, it's menacing up through a certain point in Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and there's one line when the whole series changes, and I don't know, maybe we'll save that for another day.
I would argue that right up until the first like 15 minutes of 4, and then but even then, now we're nitpicking. So
when he says "Welcome to Prime Time, bitch," that is where the series switches.
Yes,
menacing to farts.
But the only thing I would argue is that the scene in the resurrection in the junkyard in 4 is actually really well done, but then it rapidly goes downhill from there. So
we'll talk about how Nightmare 4 is the MTV Nightmare when we get to it.
Yes,
you see, Nightmare was one of those things where when it came out, it was brand new because he introduced a whole new mythology with its own rules. and its own, you know, how you die, how you avoid death, the character, what his downfalls and powers are. And yeah, and then it's just diminishing returns after that, you know. After a while, that yeah, until you ended up with a, you know, Freddy's Nightmare on Nightmares on TV, and he was
that was during the heyday.
Yeah, I know,
that was popular.
But it was still, you know, at that point, you know, Freddy Krueger, you know, as a he was a lovable host of a TV show. He was the crypt keeper on the show. He came in and told you a couple jokes and introduced the show. So you know, it takes a little bit of the piss and mystery out of him. You know what I mean? You know, once he starts hosting a TV show, you know, once it becomes, you know, at least he didn't have a talk show or something. Although that would have been awesome. And then at the end of every guest, he killed every guest at the end. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I'd pay money to see that.
The camera turns into him in the third one.
Yeah, exactly. Just that as Space Ghost, you know.
Yeah.
Done the Space Ghost with him. All right, Luke, you're next. You must get
okay, my next one, I'm going to go kind of back in time a little bit. Horror of Dracula from 1958. The score is by James Bernard. And Bernard was kind of the house composer for Hammer Studios. And Hammer, of course, was an independent studio in Great Britain that produced some of the most lavish and well-regarded horror films, gothic horror films of all time. And Horror of Dracula, I could have just as easily picked Curse of Frankenstein, which predates Horror of Dracula by a year. But Horror of Dracula has just some great range and depth for being a horror score. Really what Hammer was doing in general was remaking the universal horrors from the 30s and 40s. And they were taking the scores for a lot of these films and kind of updating them as well. So that's kind of a old-fashioned horror movie score. It's just, I'm doing air quotes up to the mic here, modernized, because this was the late 50s. So it's retro now, but it was modern then, you know. And so it's taking some of the stuff that like Hans Salter and Herman Stein and them did for the Universal films and making them more palatable. So, you know, Bernard's score for Horror of Dracula runs the gamut from, you know, quiet moodiness right through at the end when we've got Dracula being chased by Van Helsing to kind of an, you know, a rousing action theme.
Yeah.
And that theme would get used a lot in the Hammer Dracula series. In the second film, for instance, which is Dracula, Prince of Darkness, we get the exact recap, the end of the events of the first film set to that theme at the beginning. So to me, it's always just stood out because I always liked the universal themes, the, you know, the ones that had them. So I always liked the Hammer ones, and the Hammer ones just seemed a little more vivacious, you know, a little more lively, just because they had, you know, some better equipment to record with, a little bit more money, and they just fit their films so well. The Hammer films are not, you know, the most flashy films in the world. They're all in color, and they're, you know, got a little bit of titillation in them, usually in the form of, you know, the
boobies.
Hammer girls as they're. Yeah. Well, when you start getting into the 70s, in the 70s, you get some boobies, but like in the 50s and 60s, the trio is Curse of Frankenstein, Horror of Dracula, and The Mummy. You get some, you know, you get some titillation because they had a whole bevy of young girls on under contract, you know. And they'd dress them in their, you know, their the queen's best, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so Hammer films to me always. I think of color. I think of at least, you know, Cushing and Lee, a beautiful girl, and a pretty kicking soundtrack. So this is one that you can find it on CD. This one's a lot of time collected on like a Best of Hammer. There's a couple of different Best of Hammer compilation albums out there, and but. You know, if you haven't heard this, go on YouTube and search for the finale to Horror of Dracula. And first off, it's just really cool in general, the fight between Van Helsing and Dracula.
Oh,
but the soundtrack, and the big Zodiac wheel, which is, now that the film's on DVD, we can finally see what's on that damn wheel. But I would recommend it. I would love to do some Hammer at some point on this show. Just
That's without a doubt. I mean, we get to fill some Grand Guignol horror. People, go see that, you know, the Horror Dracula, 1958.
Yeah.
You need to see the young Michael Goff. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's That's my latest. That's mine. Horror of Dracula.
All right, my next one is couldn't be more different. It's Cannibal Holocaust by Riz Ortolani, which if you listen to it without seeing the movie, you would be like, what the hell are you thinking? It's very Italian synthesizer and, you know, traditional soundtrack mix with lots of 70s synthesized, like, but very sort of grand symphonic synthesized themes. And it almost is like easy listening music with a few weird parts to it. But when you put it in context with the movie, which is highly disturbing, it never washes out of your brain. It's like, I realized after I saw the movie, I was like, I have to find the soundtrack to this. And I started searching for it on the internet, and I found out that that's basically what everybody does. They see the movie and they go, I need to hear this soundtrack. And all these just horrifying things happen to this music. So when you hear it again, it's the stuck in the middle with you effect, where it's just never going to be the same. And it's also the music is in itself, it is also haunting. It's not just super cheesy. It's very haunting, but almost without the context of the movie, it would be hard to understand. But you know, it's one of those soundtracks that, like, yeah, I listen to it quite a bit. It's one of the ones that I will listen to repeatedly. And there's probably only like a half a dozen, maybe like 10 soundtracks at the most that I'll like, I want to listen to something, you know, and I'll pull it out and listen to it. And this is one of them. Yeah.
And Chris, you said that it's not just cheese. And a lot of the films, a lot of kind of the films that ripped off Cannibal Holocaust,
yes,
fall into that.
Yes.
A great example is Cannibal Feroz.
Yes.
And Cannibal Feroz was the first cannibal movie I saw, so I kind of hold it probably in more regard than it deserves. But the soundtrack to Cannibal Feroz is pretty poor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a lot of that corny, pound it out in the synth, get it out, you know, we got to get this movie done in a week sort of stuff. Whereas Cannibal Holocaust, not only is, as a film, it, you know, a good deal better than any of its ilk as far as the extremely narrow subgenre of Italian cannibal films from the
70s.
Which, believe it or not, has more film. The soundtrack is very haunting. It's almost beautiful.
It
which
is
so wrong when you know what happens in the film. It's almost impossible. In fact, I would say it probably is impossible to divorce that the sound from the visuals once you've seen the film. You can't undo that, you know, mental connection.
And no.
That makes it all the worse.
Yeah, there's a lot of parts of that movie I'd really rather not play over in my head, but for some reason, listening to the soundtrack, it compels me to.
And you can't help it.
Yeah, and it adds something to that soundtrack. It's almost like evil what it adds to the soundtrack. You know, it's
evil, all right.
It's just like someone took a little salt shaker of evil and added it to the stew, and it was just like, all of a sudden, this stew tastes a lot better with just a little bit of evil in it.
Needs more evil.
Evil and ginger. That's what it needs.
All right. I think we're back to you, Hero, right?
I think I got one more that I'll mention. Aliens. James Horner.
Definitely.
You know, it's another one where there's definitely themes that are horrific, but that was back at the time when James Horner wasn't repeating most of his own work, and not to say anything bad about the guy. He seems like a super sweet guy. I mean, his scores now are very kind of blah, but you hear the score for Aliens, and it just makes me want to, you know, go out and fight aliens. You know, love it.
Yeah, and a sign of a great soundtrack is when you it's the sign of a great soundtrack is when your score is not complete to your movie you go and rip off the another movie soundtrack. You know, and they do that. The soundtrack to Aliens, especially like, the cut where Ripley's driving the APC after the initial incursion goes horribly wrong, and she's driving the APC and running him over. You hear that in so many trailers to movies because their soundtrack is not done. That it's, you know, it's like, that's the sign of a great score, is if other people are going to rip it off. I tell you what, that theme alone, like I said, the one where she's driving the APC, may be that's one of my top 10 action-oriented themes from any film of any genre.
Yeah, the action music in that is phenomenal. It's it's probably more of an action sci-fi film than a horror film, but I think that everything about that one to me just works so well.
Yeah, it really does.
Well, Luke, how many do you got left there?
I've got two, and I think you guys each have one, and then we've got, so I think we can keep going here. So
okay,
all right. Next one on my list. This may come as no surprise to anyone who listens to my other show. Is Gojira by Akira Ifukube, and for those who may not know, Gojira was the first film in the Godzilla series. Was released in 1954 by Toho. Re-edited and released over here in the States in 1956 as Godzilla King of the Monsters. Now, one of the many things that works for the American version of this film is that they don't change the soundtrack. You would see a couple of times later in the series where the soundtrack would get chopped up or altered or replaced altogether. Doesn't happen here. So I heard this soundtrack from a very early age, and it has stuck with me and informed me for pretty much the balance of my life here. We talked about how some scores have a lot of variation, a lot of depth. This one is certainly one of them, because this was the first time we hear a lot of themes that Ifukube would revisit throughout his entire career. We get what becomes known as the March of the Monsters. This would eventually evolve into the Monster Zero March, and it's a rousing military march with a lot of drum and a lot of bass and pomp and all that. And that this bass military theme would get used over and over again. So here it's at its most basic form. It's in its almost its genesis, if you will. And then on the other hand, we get the theme when they're on Odo Island, when we find out about the legend of Gojira and the beast that comes from the sea. And it's the music is taken directly from kind of a South Seas island feel to it. A lot of times in these films, the South Seas islands would kind of be treated in the way that in a Western film we might have treated American Indians. They're like us, but they're different. They have their own culture, their own, they're quote unquote primitives and all that. So it's kind of the same way that a composer would inject some American Indian influenced sound into a Western film or something like that. And then, of course, we get Godzilla's March Through Tokyo, which is just all bass, and it's the most downbeat, hammering down sound that you can imagine. And it's combined with Honda's black and white imagery. It's just it's not something that is scary. It's just it's almost overwhelming the first time you see it, because the original Gojira is such a different film from every other film in the series. Nothing comes close to it as far as the visuals and the music combined. So, and it's just a soundtrack that I think every Godzilla fan knows. I don't think it gets enough play as just a straight horror soundtrack, because it is a science fiction film. But really, I mean, Gojira is a horror film. Yeah. It's science fiction insofar as it involves a giant monster. But really, I mean, all Goji is just a walking embodiment of the bomb.
Well, the first movie especially was a horror movie more than a science fiction movie, I think.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's a scene. The scene exists in the American version, but the dialogue has been cut. We see the mother huddling with her two young children as Goji is stomping through Tokyo. And the line in the Japanese is, "Don't worry, kids, we'll be with Daddy soon." the implication from their ages being that he died in the war.
Right, right.
Ugh. And on the train, before the train is derailed, we see one of the passengers says, "Hey, I didn't survive Hiroshima just to die here." You know, and then, I mean, and when you're in, I mean, you're 9 years removed from Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. This was everyday life.
Less, you know, less time than we are removed from 9/11.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And think about how that dominates our culture, our life. And so to think about that and then to take that and turn that cultural zeitgeist into a film and then sell that film to the people who dropped the bomb on you and make boatloads of money.
They got us.
They got us in that sense. But you know, I won't get too intellectual here about Godzilla. I'll save that for my show. But if you haven't heard Ifukube's score, Toho put out a series of scores called the Perfect Collection, which are basically it's every piece of music, even some of the outtakes and unused clips. I would recommend tracking down the Ifukube Perfect Gojira soundtrack if you're interested. Definitely worth listening to.
It's perfect.
Some films deserve the perfect soundtrack more than others. I mean, I'm looking at the perfect score to, Son of Godzilla. It's like, really? It's got some good tunes, but really?
It's perfect in that in its own context,
in its
I
own
guess.
Way.
Yes.
Back to you, Chris.
Well, my next one is now I don't know if these guys are related. This one's by Richard Band, and that's Reanimator. Unless I looked it up somewhere where they got his name on it, it would seem like he and Charles Band, like,
I could see them being
the same
yes,
person.
Yes, Charles Band is the brother of composer Richard Band.
Okay.
And they are the sons of director Albert Band.
Oh, okay. So, wow, what a tradition there.
They're getting the bands back together here.
Hey!
I just watched Reanimator recently, and I just forgot how ahead of the time that score is. It's definitely influenced by Danny Elfman in some ways.
I get more Bernard Herrmann out of that one.
It just sort of brought a jauntiness to horror movie soundtracks that sort of got copied after that. You know, when the movies it was in that beginning of the over the top horror movies, and you know they just and this one was one of the you know I remember when this movie came out and it was just like oh my god this and like Return of the Living Dead where it was just like yeah somebody's really like just pulling out all the stops as far as gore and mixing humor in there too, you know, dark humor and then putting this music onto it. That's like, you know, when the horrible stuff is happening, sometimes the music is getting downright like, you know, and it works perfectly with this. I mean, you know, the music's over the top, I can't remember the actor who played Herbert West, but he's over the top. Yeah, he's just, you know, he's a pleasure to watch just chewing on the scenery left and right.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah, I couldn't let this go without having that soundtrack mentioned.
Reanimator is one of those where it's, like you say, it's just, it's sublimely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just watch it and you're just like, oh, this is so great, you know?
Well, and as a fan of Lovecraft, I was sort of like, oh, a Lovecraft movie. And I was at first I was kind of disappointed because it wasn't dark and brooding like a Lovecraft story. But that disappeared very quickly until I was just, you know, I was like, all right, so this isn't it's actually based upon an idea by H.P. Lovecraft, and I'll take it from there, you know. And
now I will say, just mentioning real briefly about the Reanimator, are you guys familiar with the concept for the unproduced fourth Reanimator film?
No.
It was, now I remember when this was announced, and I really wanted to see this made. It never got made. It was going to be called House of Reanimator.
That's right, yeah.
And it was going to involve Herbert West in the White House.
Oh my god.
To basically to reanimate
the president.
Well, it was going to be the vice president. Because it was going to be during W's presidency. You know, so it would have been Dick Cheney that was being reanimated, and my god, that would have just been I would have loved to have seen that.
I would have loved to have seen that too, yeah. Well,
now,
I mean,
to make it, now if you could get a conservative to do that now, if you could get it out before November, I think Biden might be reanimated now. I don't know.
I was just going to say, Biden's almost like zombie-like as it is, you know.
Yeah, he looks like a marionette at times.
Yeah, well, that's just because somebody's hand is shoved up his ass. That's the only reason.
Whoa, all right. Well, let's keep the politics from
Let's keep the politics and sodomy to a minimum.
In House of Reanimator, the vice president was going to be played by George Wendt.
That's just class. Yeah. I'm always down for seeing Cheers alums do stuff.
Yeah, especially in a Reanimator movie.
When we cover House in House 2, I'll be all over that shit.
Yeah.
That's right. I saw both of those in the theater.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lucky bastard.
All right, we're back to you, Hero. You had one left, right?
I'll drop just a couple of little fun things for you. There's a most people are now familiar with the film Trick or Treat. Mm-hmm. Regarding the little pumpkin-headed guy that came out a few years ago, kind of like Creepshow. Good movie. I liked it a lot. There's a film from 1987 called Trick or Treat, which has nothing to do with that. It's about a dead heavy metal star who comes back to haunt the living after his last recording is played backwards. All very 80s cliche stuff, you know, with cameos by Gene Simmons and... Ozzy Osbourne and Skippy from Family Ties is the main character in it, which will really blow your fucking mind when you watch it. It's not great by any stretch of the imagination, but if you're a fan of the 80s milieu, you'll get a kick out of it. And the soundtrack is 100% by a band called Fastway. Fastway was the brainchild of Steve Steeman Clark from Motorhead, and the singer was Dave King, who went on to form a very successful Irish punk band, Flogging Molly. So if that doesn't, you know, rattle your brain around enough, I don't know what will. But the soundtrack is Steve Clark's a good guitarist, Dave King singing in a completely different style. If you're a fan of Flogging Molly, just go check out the first early Fastway albums. Just you'll get a kick out of it. And along the same lines as that, Return of the Living Dead, that's just got a great punk score.
Yes.
It's fun. You can't help but think of, you know, certain things. Every time I hear Do You Want a Party, I say it's party time, because that song is great, and all I can think of is Linnea Quigley buck-ass naked, dancing on top of a casket, even with the fake crotch she had on. I don't understand why they did that. It was a perfectly good real crotch they had to begin with. But
those are called merkins. She was wearing a merkin.
She was bald. It was actually bald. Watch it next time.
It was a bald merkin. Fake thing to cover up pubic hair. To
what even think about that? Leave the vagina alone.
Wow.
Yeah, I won't even tell you about the story I heard about that product called Vajazzle. So that's frightening in itself. But for good stuff. Yeah,
Google it. Is it like the Bedazzler, where it like
basically
injects rhinestones onto your vagina?
It's vagina glitter. I mean, I'm sure there's a certain
glitter gets everywhere as it is. We're gonna put it there.
Why do we need to start making it that? But Trick or Treat, Trick or Treat, I think is what it actually is. And Return of the Living Dead, good, fun rock and roll soundtracks that you know you can throw those in at the drop of a hat and just rock out to them. It's good stuff.
Well, I'll be looking forward when I score this episode to looking those up. It'll probably lead me to watching.
Somehow I'm not surprised by
that. I know I have the fast way one.
All right, we're back to you, Luke.
All right, well, I'm glad, Hero, that you picked a couple of rock and roll soundtracks, because my last one, and what may very well be my favorite soundtrack of all time, is the score to my favorite film of all time, which is Phantom of the Paradise. Now, Phantom of the Paradise was directed by Brian De Palma, but the music was entirely done by AM radio superstar Paul Williams. And Paul Williams also plays the villain of the piece. He plays Swan. And now, the soundtrack to the Phantom of the Paradise is all over the place, because you've got a couple of different characters that end up singing, because the film is a musical. Now, we get a band in there. Now, they're alternately called the Juicy Fruits, the Beach Bums, the Undeads. Basically, this band reinvents themselves throughout the film because they do what their boss tells them to do, to sing whatever song is popular. So, you know, we get a 50s doo-wop style song. Kind of a grease number is what they described it as in the ad campaign. But then they sing a Beach Boys ripoff song later on in the film. And then they sing kind of a what I would consider like Alice Cooper Band or MC5 style, almost horror-tinted song later, even later in the film. And it's the same three guys the entire time, you know. And then the main character, Winslow, he's a composer, and he's writing his cantata, a pop cantata about the story of Faust. And so we get his songs throughout the film singing about selling your soul to the devil and, you know, that you would do anything to be loved and to love someone else. And, you know, and then we get the girl, Phoenix, and she has her songs that she sings. And one of them is a straight pop number. And then the other is this extremely haunting ballad about lost love and the two lovers who are destined never to be together. And just this entire soundtrack, like I said, it ranges from, on the trailers for the film, they said from Grease to Glitter and beyond, because this film was 1974. So it's easy listening, it's hard rock, there's a bit of horror rock in there in the middle, and I have listened to this album literally over 1,000 times. I can listen to this album at any time. Back in high school, I listened to this so much I would just be walking along and just start singing it. There's a little interstitial, which is the only track that's not featured on the soundtrack, where it's Paul Williams singing about that. I never thought I'd get to meet the devil. Never thought I'd meet him face to face. You know, and I just walk around singing that. You know. So, you know, I heard he never wrote or used the phone, so I went right up to meet him at his place. And I'm a huge fan of this movie to begin with, as you know, because since you couldn't tell that from how I've been gushing for 5 minutes about it. But the music from it, the thing about Paul Williams is a lot of times is kind of just dismissed as an easy listening guy or an AM radio guy. But as far as, you know, songwriters, just guys who could write good songs, Paul Williams has always been one of the best. And his take on this was, you know, it's a little bit Phantom of the Opera. It's a little bit Faust. It's got some elements of James Whale's Frankenstein, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, The Picture of Dorian Gray. All the different influences that Brian De Palma brought to this, Paul Williams reflects all of that. And I think it's just a great soundtrack. I think in some ways it was ahead of its time, having the soundtrack of all, you know, rock and roll and pop songs for a horror film, but it was something that's been a big influence in my life. I absolutely love this soundtrack. I say go find it, get it off of Amazon, use the Two True Freaks link and buy it off of Amazon. You will not be disappointed.
I remember you had Tommy and Jesus Christ Superstar sort of to pave the way for it, or to, you know, around the same time.
And this led directly, both visually and sonically, into Rocky Horror.
Oh, because yeah.
Rocky Horror Show, not the picture show, but the stage show,
play.
In 74, right around the time of this, and they both kind of came from that same swelling, that same underground feeling, and that they tap into the same sort of you know, artistic direction. You can, I mean, I was friends with a girl in college who was a huge, huge Rocky Horror fan. And I said, Beth, have you ever seen Phantom of the Paradise? And she said, I've never even heard of that. So we sat down and watched Phantom of the Paradise. She just sat watching it goggle-eyed.
Oh, yeah. She was that like, must oh, have been is... awesome.
Yeah. So we'd often, you know, we'd have fun just quoting Rocky Horror and Phantom back at each other. But my friend Mac always said I'd make a good, what's Meatloaf's character in Rocky Horror? What's his name?
Eddie, yes.
I'd make a good Eddie from, I'd make a good Eddie if we ever did a production of Rocky Horror. And Hot Patootie, Bless My Soul, was part of my weekly Friday Classes Over mix that I would play every week at school. So, but yeah, definitely Paul Williams' soundtrack to Phantom of the Paradise. If you're talking about a soundtrack that has songs instead of music, this is top of the notch. So
I agree. So that leads us.
You've used a little bit of upholstery at one point,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
On an episode.
Mm-hmm. And someday we'll have an episode dedicated just to that movie. I watched that movie on your recommendation, and I loved it. I couldn't believe that I went 40 years, you know, without seeing that. You know. And I'm a big Brian De Palma fan too. So I just I knew about it, but I just for some reason. Never watch it. It's fantastic. Yeah, it's just got so many awesome parts to it that it's Well, that leads us into our sort of last little chunk of stuff, which is going to lead into our game plan for what's coming up on the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror.
Yeah.
So I'll start it out with my last. I had a doubleheader on my list. It was two by the band Goblin, which sort of goes along because it's more in the rock band sort of world of Suspiria and Dawn of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Which I picked Dawn of the Dead, but then I was like, you know what? As far as a Goblin score goes, I think the Suspiria one is superior to Dawn of the Dead. But I love the Dawn of the Dead Goblin score.
Interesting on Dawn of the Dead, in the opening credits, the soundtrack is actually credited to Dario Argento and the Goblins.
Mm-hmm.
And this credit was done because Argento and Romero, they were, if I'm remembering this correctly, and I may be a little off in the details, they were contemporaries. You know, they knew each other and everything, and it was Argento who recommended Goblin to Romero to score the film. And of course, Dawn of the Dead went on to be released as Zombie, Z-O-M-B-I, in Italy after being re-edited by Dario Argento. So to pay tribute to the guy who suggested the band to him, Romero credited Argento as part of the score for that reason. And Suspiria soundtrack is so weird.
Mm-hmm.
And so, just so knee deep in the prog rock sound, but at the same time, really influenced, I think, by trying to sound supernatural and witchy,
yes.
Because
yes.
it's a movie about witchcraft. That it's just bizarre. The Anchor Bay 3-disc special edition of Suspiria, the third disc is the soundtrack. And I would put that on sometimes when I was cleaning the house, when I was home by myself. And you get to the middle of it, and it's just like weird, like drum percussion solos,
yeah.
Like 3-4 minutes at a clip, and then just weird, just weird like keyboard sound and stuff. It's wonderfully strange, you know, and it really fits. It fits so good.
Mm-hmm. That's what I like soundtracks like that where there's just a, you know, a big sonic palette for what they used to create it. And that one is one of those where they're not afraid to go completely atmospheric and, you know, kind of, I don't know how much of it like would actually be called like improvisational. And it, you know, they are a kind of an art rock band, but even this, the stuff that sounds kind of improvisational has a sort of structured aspect to it, so it's hard to tell, you know. But yeah, I both of those, I can listen to like Goblin music pretty much any as soundtrack music or just as prog rock music.
Yeah, you know? And what's interesting also about the Suspiria one in general, let me tell you, I'm typical Italian. I got to tell you a story for him to make a point. When I was a younger man, I used to do semi-annual horror movie marathons called Horror Festicon. And on the last Horror Festicon, which I did right before I became a dad, because I kind of lost the ability to really organize them at that point because everybody had moved to the Four Winds and everything else. The last film we watched was Suspiria. So it's about 1 a.m. we're watching this movie. And we're about, you know, 15, 20 minutes into it. And we're in a real kind of intense scene where there's no dialogue. It's just the soundtrack and the visuals. And my friend Mac turns to me, he goes, "I am scared out of my fucking mind right now." So that, to me, tells the tale of how good if a horror soundtrack elicits that kind of response, you know it's doing something right.
It's
doing
something absolutely right, yes.
Yeah. And the thing about Dawn of the Dead is that it's more of a low-key Goblin soundtrack,
yes.
But I think it fits the movie. Because when you really get down to it, I mean, you think about most of the films that Goblin scored. They're Argento's films, and so they're visual, they're bright and visual and, you know, sweeping camera moves and all this kind of stuff. Whereas Romero's style is, in a lot of ways, it's much more grounded.
It's almost
documentarian.
Mm-hmm.
Which has always been one of Romero's strengths, is to make you believe this is real. So that kind of minimalist score, it doesn't really intrude, it just kind of, you know, hangs out there. I think that suits Dawn of the Dead really well, especially once they get to the mall.
Yeah.
I mean, a scene with, who's the pilot, John? When the pilot is down in the bowels, and the one dead is coming after him, and the gun is, he drops all the bullets and all that. The soundtrack there, that's one of the best uses of the soundtrack in the whole film. And that's just real kind of subtle, quiet music almost.
Just as a little honorable mention, some of the music like the gonk, the cheesy background music, came from the DeWolf Library.
Yeah.
who now that I've found out about the DeWolf Library, it's going to become my goal to track down, like, I know there's got to be like a 500 record set of the DeWolf Library out there somewhere, and I'm coming for it.
You know, one of the, mentioning Goblin, one of the other films that they scored that is one of my absolute favorites is a film called Profondo Rosso, which translates to Deep Red. And the soundtrack to that, as, you know, whereas Suspiria leaned towards more the ethereal type of sound, this is a really kind of hard-hitting, tactile sound, for lack of
yes.
a better descriptor.
I discovered that one because I used it for Walking Dead Wednesday once.
Yes.
And I was just like, this is awesome.
Yeah. And being a giallo instead of a supernatural film, it kind of needs that tactility because everything is physical in the film. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's a physical killer. There's physical weapons, things of that nature. And that one, as far as, I mean, you want to talk about a rock soundtrack. I mean, that is, you could take that stuff out of, except for one or two tracks, you could take it all and just listen to it as just straight, you know, instrumental prog rock. And it works really good. You know, the thing about Goblin was that they had the chops to play the music, which helps, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, if you're going to have a rock score, you need a band that can play rock music. And just another interesting thing about Deep Red and is that that's a soundtrack that never lets up. Part of the design of the film is that it offers you no relief. Once certain things happen, there is no more relief in the film, and the soundtrack plays into that. In that, almost every little bit is scored. It's a common criticism that, you know, we can't have an Italian movie without every second of it being scored. But in the case of Profondo Rosso, it serves a purpose, at least. It's not just to fill up the soundtrack.
Right, right. We don't have any noise going on.
Yeah. It's like the opposite of a Japanese movie, where there'll be just, you know, 10 minutes of no one talking and no sound.
Yes. No, not with the Italians, no.
Yeah. No. They're a verbose people.
Yeah.
Yes, we need
and,
some.
And actually, the most well-known of the Italian kind of rock horror composers was Goblin, but there was another composer. His name was Fabio Frizzi. And Fabio Frizzi, he didn't work with Dario Argento, but he worked a lot with Lucio Fulci. And Frizzi did a lot of synthesizer stuff. I think you can find some similarities between his stuff and Carpenter. And one of the things that's very similar about them is they both like to use leitmotifs. We talked about this on the Halloween episode, that Carpenter has certain leitmotifs that he would reuse over and over in the soundtrack anytime he needed a certain aspect of the soundtrack to be emphasized. Fabio Frizzi does the same thing. Probably his one of his most well-known soundtracks is to Zombie 2, Zombie 2, also known as Zombie Zombie here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And the opening theme to that is hands down, I think, the creepiest piece of music I've ever heard in my life. Again, I'll tell you another story. When I was in college, I was introducing all my friends to horror in general. You know, most of them were horror neophytes, and you know, part of that included watching Italian horror. And we were on, we're at Clemson University, and they lived in what is known as the shoeboxes. The shoeboxes were four dormitories that were, the rooms looked like little shoeboxes. That's how they got their name. And this was down the hill, about, I'd say maybe a quarter mile from the dormitory I lived in. So I remember we watched Zombie 2 one night, and you know, we got like 6, 7, 8 guys crammed in this tiny room all watching this movie, right? And movie ends, and we take care of whatever, you know, shit we got to do, and I'm walking back up the hill. It's about 12:30, 1 in the morning. It's pitch black out, and I'm by myself, and all I can hear is dun 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 dun. I'm like, oh shit, I'm gonna get eaten by zombies. Oh, I don't want to get eaten by zombies. So I'm not too proud to admit that I hoofed it up that hill.
I think I've seen that. Is that the movie where the zombie pulls a woman's head into the splinter of wood?
Yes. Yep.
Yes, I've seen that one.
Yeah. And so Frizzi, again, if it gets you freaked out enough that you're scared, you know, it's done its job. And just real quick, the other one that's like that for Fabio Frizzi, which kind of thematically connects with some of the ones we talked about earlier, is The Beyond. Now, The Beyond deals with the supernatural in a very kind of oblique way. But the soundtrack is very similar in a lot of ways to The Omen, in that it's choral for the most part. Has a lot of chanting and things that sound like it could have come from a really evil version of a Catholic mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was always been another favorite of mine, just something to put on as mood music. If you're doing like a horror gaming session or something, it's really kind of perfect in the background for that. Because it taps into those, oh man, this is about this. This is about Satanism. This is really bad, you know?
Yes.
I think we'll have ample opportunity to discuss all the Italian composers in the coming months here on the Vault of Startling Horror Monster Tales of Terror.
Yes, so, we're going into a new phase after this. We're out of the John Carpenter phase, and we're going to Italy.
Yeah.
It's party time, Italian style, fellas.
When in Rome.
Yeah, exactly.
And, die as the Romans do. So.
And speaking of Rome and Italy, fresh from Italy, we'll be bringing in Joe Anthrax, who just came back from a trip from Italy.
Yeah.
So.
I'm looking forward because.
Oh, DiMonzo's going to be so happy.
Yeah. He really is.
Yeah, I'm sure he's thrilled.
Well, you know, the thing is that before he took the trip, Mr. Anthrax and I, and I, every time I say that, I always pause for the obligatory Mr. Anthrax is my father. Yuck, yuck, yuck joke. But we had talked over PM and such on the board, and I had, you know, gotten him to watch an Argento film, and he really enjoyed it, and so we've been talking back and forth. So I'm really looking forward to getting his point of views on some of the films we're going to be watching for this little jaunt, the primer on Italian horror.
Well, you're going to be the sort of ringleader on this, or the scoutmaster, the evil scoutmaester of
maestro.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, perfect word. So that's what? True. What is our first assignment for?
Think of it as assignment. It should be enjoyable.
It will be enjoyable.
But the first film we're gonna watch. My thinking is we're gonna start with Italian horror. We've got to start with the grandpapa of Italian horror, and that's Mario Bava. And Mario Bava's directorial debut was actually a horror film. In 1960, he directed The Mask of Satan, which is much better known by its U.S. title Black Sunday, which stars Barbara Steele and who else is in this? I forget who else is in it, but Barbara Steele is the one everybody remembers from it.
Yes.
And now Black Sunday is available on Netflix. It's under Black Sunday. It's also under La Maschera del Demonio, which is, again, The Mask of Satan. Anchor Bay released this in their Box of Bava, which was a 5-DVD set. Released this a couple of years ago at this point. But as I said, it's just a tight little film that really kind of sets the stage for some of the other films we're going to be watching and gives an idea about how Italian horror works and how it's different from other from films from other countries. So I'm really looking forward to it. I haven't seen Black Sunday in a couple of years at this point. So I'm looking forward to watching it again and hearing what everybody's got to say about it. And just real quick, just to give everyone an idea of where we're going, we're going to be watching a few more films from Mario Bava. We're definitely going to be watching a few films from Dario Argento. I've got a few films from Lucio Fulci. And then I'm going to start digging into the archives a little bit and find some lesser-known films. Anchor Bay was great about this, and now Shriek Show has kind of taken over. Shriek Show is a Media Blaster's horror imprint about releasing some of these hard-to-find, long out of print, long thought lost European, specifically Italian, but other countries as well, horror films. And they've been a real blessing to the horror film community. And that's one of the great things about DVD, I've always said, is that, VHS had, even in the 80s, grew to the level it was going to grow, and it was never going to get any bigger. It was going to take a sea change to really grow the horror market, and that's what DVD did. So and God bless them for companies like Anchor Bay and Shriek Show. So, but yeah, we're going to get started with Black Sunday. So I hope everybody enjoys it. I'd love to hear. I'm really looking forward to hearing what everybody thinks about this, just because it's as unique and different from everything else as John Carpenter's stuff was. This stuff, Bava's films are going to be as unique and different themselves.
This one's also in black and white too, huh?
Yeah, this is going to be
I'm looking forward to that.
Only our second film in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right.
I got some spumoni ready and spaghetti and some Chef Boyardee macaroni and cheese.
Oh, why do movies that taste so good have to be so bad for you?
You need to taste the salt good.
Excellent. All right.
Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it, or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
Fail, leave it, but things are right. Everything is cool. Hey, dude, say I like your style. You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass. And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled SCOTTGARDNER.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
And this is your Uncle Don saying good night.
Good night, little kids. Good night.
We're off?
Good. Well, that ought to hold the little bastards.